You're listening to the I Love You Keep Going podcast with George Haas. For more information, please visit our website at www.metagroup.org. That's www.metagroup.org.
So welcome, everybody. This is I Love You Keep Going. It is April 4th, 2024. It's 7:35 p.m. Pacific Daylight Time. And I thought that I would talk about what can stall your exploration as a topic. I do talk a lot about exploration because it's one of the central themes of secure attachment. You have the attachment system itself, the mentalizing and emotional regulation system, and then the collaborative relationship system. Or another way to talk about it is the attachment system, the exploration system, and the collaborative relationship system. The attachment system and the collaboration system are kind of like a toggle. If the exploration system is active, it means that the attachment system is deactivated. When the attachment system activates, it deactivates the exploration system. But the collaborative system stays on in either case. So when we talk about the exploration system stalling, what we're mostly talking about is getting into a state where the attachment system is active, and so that the exploration is not happening. If you don't really track these states very well, then it may be confusing why exploration doesn't go well or why you can't do it in some situations and in other situations that you can do it. And it also goes way back to the conditioning and the training that you had in your early family systems about how that developed. I like to talk about it also as primary exploration and secondary exploration. Secondary exploration is the gathering of time, energy, and resources that you can then use to support primary exploration. Primary exploration is where the activity of the exploration provides meaning for your life. Let me close this door. So a lot of moving parts. And so a wrench can get thrown into the gears pretty easily somewhere along the way. We also then have this overlay, which I think is important to talk about, which is our culture and what it deems valuable and what it thinks of as not particularly valuable. I'm always fascinated by the way that things are rewarded in our culture, really because of the technology that we have now and the vastness of the numbers that are associated with large groups. And how the very small contributions of remuneration from individuals when the group is large enough turns into just a tidal wave of money. It's an amazing thing. And so really what becomes important isn't so much meaning, but as gathering a large group so that you can make a lot of money from it. I find a lot of those kinds of things uninteresting because of the lack of meaning in them. And then we have this whole, in some sense, movement of these false realities like reality television, which is, it seems to me, completely artificial, but I do see that it resonates in the culture with a sense of meaning or sense of distraction, maybe. So all of these layers are happening. You're growing up, you're introduced to the culture of your family system and what's valuable in your family system. Often in family systems, there's a pressure to achieve. When you find yourself in a family situation where there's a lot of pressure to achieve at particular things that actually don't mean anything to you, and you get good at achieving, it creates this dissonance of, I'm good at doing these things, and yet they don't mean anything to me beyond the remuneration. When there's a lot of pressure to achieve in childhood, the actual concerns and interests and needs of the child are not developed. And so you have this contradiction of an accomplished, capable collection of activities that don't have any meaning, but there's no skill developed around understanding what really is meaningful and how to pursue that. So that's one of the big ways that exploration fails to provide much in the way of meaning. Once you come out of the family system, you go into a broader cultural system, and then the things that are rewarded there, typically because we value competition so much in our culture, we're in a place of competing in sports or competing in some kind of academic pursuit right off the bat. And there's these hierarchies. There's a hierarchy. What was the first year in your schooling where you got letter grades as opposed to just checks? I remember the first few years of elementary school, there were these long forms and these sort of checks from, good to bad and poor, not great, okay, better than average, excellent, and whatever they were. And all sorts of things were being monitored, all sorts of behaviors were being monitored. And then the letter grades, and then the social standing that went along with competing well in that, or if you were good at sports, a social standing that went along with it. So we really are indoctrinated into this system of competition and what's valuable in our culture. And again, not so much with the attention to what it is that's meaningful to us, what it is that we're good at. I think one of the things, an example of that might be the ADHD debate that is happening now, which is it's looking more and more like that's just a normal adaptation, a normal variation in the way that human beings are. And the reason that it's problematic is not because it's an evolutionary norm, but because we have these very narrow systems for learning that are not widely adaptable to the variations of that. So there, even the systems of rating people in these in the way that the education system is structured doesn't assess that much. You're good at you happen to have a skill set that aligns with the way all of this material is being related to you. And that's a reflection of that evaluation. And that if you learn differently or you have interests that are different than that, that isn't what is rewarded. And so you're penalized for that in order to push you into what we have use for. This, of course, begs the question of, as Mary Oliver says, what are you going to do with this one wild and precious life of yours? Make this joke, and actually, some people don't think it's a joke, which is we really want to work hard. And so, the last thing that we say at our deathbed is, I'm so happy I increased shareholder value. That would not be something that I would be hoping to say. I was trying to count the number of times that my internet feed just fed me pictures of big houses, and it was an alarming number, like 25 times a day I see pictures of big houses. The whole culture pushing toward this consumptive social status, gathering of resources, position as the ultimate success, when except when you look at the destruction that it's causing the planet and the end of the habitability for everybody. It's a very puzzling way. This is what's valuable. I like to say, when I went to school, the school system could afford to buy chalk so that the teachers had something to write with. And then the constant news of fun drives for basic school materials, whiteboard markers so that teachers can teach. That doesn't relieve us. The cultural conditions don't relieve us of the dilemma of what's meaningful to us. It may often create limitations that make it hard to do that. When you're a child, you begin to explore, I would say, reasonably around a year old, when you're just getting up on twos, and you're already up on four, and you can crawl around and find out things. And in a determined way, which is your own agenda, I might add to that, since every moment is an exploration. I was spent a few hours with a I guess the 5-day-old baby. Every now and then it would open its eyes and look around, and then there'd be an expression of wonder, and then it would fall back asleep. Did you have sensitively enough caregivers who attuned to you, who really were interested in what it was that excited you, and did they do their best to support you in discovering that? And when you went for things, even if they didn't have social value, even if they weren't what the family thought you were going to would be of use, did they support that and encourage that? Did they find interest in that? That's the question. And if they did, then you probably developed the skills that you needed to explore the kinds of things that were interesting to you, and then off you could go. And then you had people to come back with. So that whole cycle is moving toward the things that are interesting, finding meaning, and then coming back and expressing the discoveries that you make with the expectation that the people that you've chosen to share with will be delighted in the experience of what you've discovered. And if that didn't happen, something else happened. One of the things that we notice about exploration is that most of the time, the gestures that you make, the investigations that you make, don't really lead anywhere. What you find out mostly is that this isn't the direction to go in. And so there's a kind of resiliency that's also necessary for exploration. The resiliency comes early, that early training in resilience, in the form of emotional regulation and encouragement. You've ever been around small kids, and they run along and then they fall down, and there's this whole range of sensations that come into the body from falling down, and then they turn around and they look at their caregiver for an indication of what to do with that. And they could get from the caregiver, oh, you're all right, get up, let's keep going. Not a big deal. And then the child learns to tolerate these intensities and then keep going, or the parent rushes in and picks up the child and says, we can't do that anymore, we have to stop, it's too dangerous. The child learns then kind of helplessness in the face of that kind of difficulty. So this does lay out onto the attachment map pretty well. Secure kids have caregivers that are interested in the things that interest them, and they get support to pursue those things. There's some attention to doing well in the world, but also in maintaining that place of interest and meaning. One of my friends who's raised kids who seem to be pretty good, that I don't care what you do, but you have to do your best. That was the admonishment. And so there was a lot of inquiry as to what it was that they would do, and they got to choose all of that. But she insisted that they really try and to do their best at it. And there was no loss of affection if they didn't do well, because the scale of what was used to evaluate was their best, not some other ranking. In family systems where inhibitions to exploration really arise, because of the directedness of the caregiver involvement in what a child should select to do, or how badly role reversed the child is in terms of responsibility for care for the caregiver, you can develop these patterns of procrastination, which I like to talk about as a fear of succeeding in exploration. In order for a child to explore, they have to go off. They have to separate from the caregiver. So the caregiver then has to be available and regulating enough that they can take off and go on a little solo adventure. But then they also have to be reliably available to the child as a base to explore from. So it's this movement out into exploring and coming back, and this movement out into exploring and coming back. And if the caregiver interferes with that natural development, then there's repercussions that need to be addressed. If the caregiver, this is quite common, feels anxious in the separation, they often interfere with the child's ability to go and explore. Or if the child goes off and explores and the caregiver gets dysregulated in the absence, when the child comes back, they're not greeted with a sense of delight. They're not greeted with a sense of interest. And the child doesn't have the experience of being able to express what was meaningful in the exploration that they engaged in. Christian?
George, would you say that there's like the common preoccupied reasoning for that limiting of the exploration from the caregiver would be like a fear of abandonment, like the role reversal is already there, but that there's also like, I'm curious if there's also like a fear that the child will get hurt, if that's kind of a preoccupied thing. I know there's the dismissive category where they're afraid that the child will like die, but I'm curious about like the reasons for limiting the exploration.
The reasoning is often not what actually is happening. The caregiver does not adequately assess what the risks are to the child, or actually what the benefit of doing it is to the child. What is important in the development of your skills and capacities in childhood is that the goalpost is constantly being moved so that it's just within reach of your ability at the moment. You don't want to push
the child with.
What?
Torture the child with.
I didn't say just out of reach. I said within reach, right?
Okay, yeah.
So that the child can reach it, but they have to stretch to reach it. Not where you move it beyond what the child can do so that they can't reach it. That's very defeating, very limiting of exploration. Gotcha. It really creates a very negative sense of self when parents do that. You want to move the goalposts so that they can get it, but they have to stretch to get it, and they can reliably get it. That creates in the mind of the child, I can really stretch for things and I'll get them, as opposed to there's no point in trying because it's out of reach.
So you're saying I should stop giving my friends the myth of Sisyphus as their newly born.
Right. You know, what we forget about Sisyphus is he betrayed one of his relationships, and that was the punishment. Even so, I'm all for the liberation of Sisyphus. When a child has the experience that if they separate from the caregiver becomes dysregulated, or that they're okay to separate, but when they come back, they're punished from it, what they begin to do is associate a loss of affection, a loss of care with exploration. It's one of the big interrupting factors. And so what you'll notice in kids who have had that experience is that they procrastinate. Procrastination is a hedge, really. If I do my very best, and so you have a parent that doesn't respond with delight to a child doing their best, then if I do my best and I'm punished for that, then I need to set up a situation where I don't do my best so I can preserve the fear of doing my very best and losing affection. An example was one of my best buddies in high school came in number two in the state of Illinois for tumbling, and his father's remark was, "Where's my number one trophy?" That would be moving the goalpost too far. That if you do your very best and you don't make it, then you're not good enough and affection is withdrawn. So I'm going to set up a situation where I don't do my best so that I have a hedge where I can tell myself, well, I've lost affection, but had I done my best, I could have managed to keep it. So you delay, you delay, you delay, you delay until you can't do your best. And then you rush to finish. And then there's another side of it, which is, I didn't do my very best and you think it's terrific, so that you can't really see me. You don't really know me. Christian?
Do you think that's like a natural impulse in the child to understand it that way, or they'd have to be taught that? Like how would a child feel unseen by being praised for not doing their best?
Well, it's a way of devaluing the praiser, right? So you don't have to depend on them. If you really could see me, what we want more than everything else is to be seen and to be appreciated for who we are, to be accepted for who we are, to be valued for who we are. And if you are the judge and I don't do my very best and yet I get the praise for that, then you are not a good judge. I don't have to value you. Go ahead.
Will the child be reacting to praise that seems incongruent with, like, that's not like you're okay, but like that's just kind of lying to them about how well they did?
It could be a kind of empty praise, or it could be a sincere praise. But in the mind of the child, it's that you can't see me and you don't know what I'm capable of. I don't have to value you. So to give you an example of that, I read somewhere that Marlon Brando, on the first day of shooting a movie with the director, would intentionally do a really good take and intentionally do a not good take. And if the director couldn't tell the difference between them, he wouldn't consider the director's opinion. So that's part of how that insulates us. We don't have to care about you because you can't tell anyway.
I guess I'm curious, Marlon Brando being a paragon of secure attachment.
Clearly.
I'm curious. It just sounds to me like that reaction in a child already would have a sort of dismissive quality. Or if you think there's kind of security there.
I think it could be also a disorganized child reaction. You know, disorganized people are frightened to express themselves clearly because they're afraid of what would happen. And in that evaluation, they're that person isn't of use, really, if that makes sense. What we want to do is go out into the world, discover the things that have meaning, that have resonance to us, and then have a select group of people that we can then express that to and get their response to it. In adult relationships, of course, primary exploration needs to be well matched in a relationship so that there's a synergy that happens in the going out and finding what you need to know, coming back and expressing it. And if each person is going out and discovering the things that have meaning and coming back and expressing it, there has to be enough interest, enough knowledge in the other person for you to be able to explain something to them and for them to be able to get it and delight in it and you to have that genuine experience of it. Did you ever discover something that was really fantastic and exciting and you tried to explain it to somebody and they had no clue what you were talking about? I would suggest meditators have had this experience quite a lot.
It's never happened to me, George.
I got into this amazing state. No, you didn't. That's impossible. One of the things that's important, and I did start by talking about what stalls exploration. If you're not trained to explore, then you haven't really started, and you need to begin to figure this out, how to explore, what's meaningful to you. If you really have never had much support or interest in exploring, then actually the good news is you could try anything and that would be the direction to go in because you haven't tuned into anything particularly. And what we do in exploration is we really attend to how meaningful the experience is that we're having. That's the nature of primary exploration. I sometimes talk about it in terms of my photography. which is something that's quite meaningful to me, and I spend a lot of time on it, is taking a picture and looking at the picture, and then looking at aspects of the picture that I like and work for me and engage me with interest, and then plucking that out and in re-photographing or making another photograph, including that element in there, and then looking and seeing what other elements are in the picture, and a gradual distillation process of dropping the elements that don't mean anything or don't make sense to me, and collecting the aspects that do. And then eventually what happens is you have a vocabulary for a particular type of picture that has been gathered through the process of making the pictures, the photographs, looking at them and selecting from what comes up in that. So in some sense, you bypass the sense of self, you bypass the sense of cultural conditioning and engage in that unconscious process of involving yourself in your being, if that makes sense. And then having it. And then, of course, everything is impermanent. Everything is changing. And so moving into the next thing, the next direction that you're going in. So it's a constant gathering of data, evaluating for meaning, moving further in that direction or away from that direction because of the richness of meaning in it. And then over time, in this constant process of doing that, finding yourselves in these paths of exploration that resonate. And then in the discoveries that you make, having that small group of people around you that you express it to, the expression is part of it. And then what you see in different attachment strategies is limitations on that model. For instance, dismissing people are very oriented around secondary exploration, the gathering of resources, gathering of power, the gathering of social position. And they tend to keep the primary exploration private and secretive. And it's unusual for them to actually feel safe and free to talk about it. And that comes from childhood experiences where there's a demand for idealizing. So idealizing is in some sense tuning into the values of the caregiver and presenting a very positive view of them, which also means stripping out the negative aspects of it. So the child is in this position of having to understand what the caregiver finds valuable and presenting that in an ideal way, and at the same time stripping out any negativity that might balance it. Often their own interests, their own personal exploration is reacted to by the caregivers as an expression of something negative. And so the child learns to withhold that in order to preserve their capacity for meaning. That making sense. So the idea there, because that's such a rejecting experience for a child, is to, if you're in the dismissing camp, begin to risk really telling people what's authentically meaningful to you in the hope that they'll respond with interest and delight that you've figured that out. And moving in the direction of people who do respond that way, not in the idealized way that you're used to, but in an expression of genuine interest. Preoccupied people are, of course, the ones where their capacity to explore has been really truncated by the relationship with the caregiver. And so there's a lot to do in terms of discovering how to evaluate for meaning, what is meaningful, and then how to pursue that. The difficulty that disorganized people have with exploration is often the chaotic emotional experience of life for them. It really is hard for them to emotionally regulate. It's really hard for them to settle the attachment system. And so they constantly have these activated attachment systems which interfere with the opening of the exploration system. What you'll notice is that when the attachment system is active and the exploration system is deactivated, you can't solve problems in the exploration system very well. It goes fallow, if you will, where you can't make much progress in the exploration. Then you have to attend to settling the attachment system, which means connection. And for disorganized people, connection is really challenging. So that's the conundrum there. So what you notice in that group is a lot of beginnings. The attachment system shuts down, they get regulated. The exploration system opens up and there's almost a sprint to get something done, to get something to happen, because there's this fearfulness that at any moment the attachment system could turn on and they won't be able to get it to shut off, and then the exploration will stop. Or they'll get kicked off the team that they're on, won't be able to play on. So it is useful to understand what your attachment conditioning is, so that you have a sense of what you're looking at in terms of exploration, and then begin to develop the deficits that you have in relationship to this so that you can begin to have a fruitful exploration. So cure people really are already doing this with less sensitivity to the culture demands, less sensitivity to the family system demands. There's always been some attention to what was meaningful to them, and always attention to how to pursue it. Dismissing people usually are pretty good explorers, but they're not attending much to the primary exploration and not sharing it, not expressing it. So that's the thing for them. Preoccupied people need to learn the basics of exploration for meaning. Sometimes they can explore pretty well. Sometimes they can support somebody else's exploration pretty well. But when they have to direct it themselves, not much happens. There's that piece of taking it over, in some sense, abandoning the helplessness, abandoning the inability to, or the claim for the inability to solve problems and take that on. Disorganized people really do need to attempt to reorganize themselves or organize themselves so that they can be in a place of better mentalizing, better emotional regulation, so that they can turn off that attachment system and float the exploration system so they can really go for things. The accumulation of disappointment is also something that we should consider. One of the things about having a lot of beginnings, some middles, and no finishes is the disappointment of not being able to finish accumulates. Particularly with procrastinators, the thing about procrastination when it's really, really playing out is the closer you get to succeeding, the greater the anxiety is that you'll lose affection. And at a certain point of the anxiety of succeeding, is unbearable, you intentionally fail to relieve the anxiety. It's a calculation. The anxiety of succeeding is way up here, and the disappointment of failing is considerably below that. If you intentionally fail, you reduce the distress quite a lot. It's not that failure feels good. It doesn't. But it's at least manageable in comparison to the fearfulness of succeeding at something. But that collects disappointment. And once you get to a place where the disappointment is accumulated to the point that you just can't bear to experience it anymore, you stop taking the risk of exploring. Not because you don't long for the discoveries that you would make, but because you can't bear to ride out another wave of disappointment and not being able to get it to go. So that's another piece to look at, to change your mind about the disappointment and then take a look at it from this attachment frame so you can make more sense about it. And then also understand this process of looking at the experiences that they're engaging in from the point of view of their meaningfulness to you, and then reorient toward the things that have more meaning, and, you know, set aside the societal meaning or the pressure from the family system, so that it's actually something that's satisfying to you, meaningful to you. And then find that group of people that resonates with that so that you have the capacity for expression of it. Because that whole piece is there, the discovery, the rushing back to the people that are supporting you as you explore, and that exuberant expression of what you find out. You may have noticed this in our society. We do tend to celebrate successes, right? The far enemy, of course, of that is envy and jealousy. When we get our capacity to explore interfered with, it's easy to slip into that sense of jealousy, sense of envy at other people's successes. So that's that last piece, really being joyful at other people doing well, really expressing and holding space for their expression of what they're doing, so that then they will, in a collaborative, reciprocal relationship, hold that space for you. We can fully experience it. Why don't we do some meditation? What do you think, metta or Vipassana? Vipassana. So go ahead and take your meditation posture. All right, let go of the meditation. How's that? Good enough? So Saturday, we're starting a new level one. So for the four Saturdays in April, that's what's happening, from 9 until 1 p.m. Pacific. I'm going to do a workshop on meditation and addiction on Friday, May 3rd. And then I'm going to go to Poland and do a retreat on May 7th. So we won't be meeting. I'll come back on June 17th, and then we will meet. And then I'm also going to do another meditation and addiction workshop on Friday, the 21st of June. And then we're going to begin a series of meditation and addiction half days, starting on June 29th, so 9 to 1. And that will go for 3 Saturdays. I'm going to do a 15-day retreat in Poland and a 4-day commuter retreat in Utrecht at the end of May. So if you feel like either of those, might be fun to see you there. Thank you for coming. I really appreciate your practice. I offer the teaching freely, but I do hope if you're a resource, you'll consider making a donation. It helps support me and also the work that Meta Group is doing. See you soon.